You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the 10th to the 16th of March. I'm your host David Matthews and I'm joined by reporters Ellie Bothwell and Jack Grove. So in this week's issue, we've got new data that suggests that the end of student grants in the UK could see students take on more work while they study, or you could even put them off going to university altogether. Ellie has a big new survey of what's going on in higher education across Europe, including a new ranking and some insights from a very corrupt Ukrainian higher education system and more competitive German one. And then finally, we have news of a X Factor style live audience selection process for new academics. Is this a good way to decide who gets a job? But first, Jack, results of a new survey of students.
Yes, this is a biannual survey undertaken by the catering firm Sodexo, and it's a really quite interesting piece of work in that students are quizzed on all sorts of aspects of student life. You know, from how they sort of spend their time, how they spend their money, you know, what their sort of priorities and fears are. This year, they decided to ask some interesting questions about the potential impact of the loss of student grants in autumn. For the first time, new students from low-income families won't have student grants. In the 9K era, and so it's interesting to consider how this might affect not just whether students go to university, but what they do when they're at university, because the UCAS figures released recently for this year show that application rates are doing pretty well, but this poll suggests that of the people who they asked who pick up student grants, about one in five said that they would have delayed their studies for a year to work and save money. Something like almost a third said that they would take on more work during the holidays. 29% said they would take on more part-time work in term time. So it's just sort of be interesting to think about how the loss of grants is going to affect student behaviour.
I mean, there's about 500,000 who take grants at the moment, is that right? And yeah, it's about 18% said, well, we just wouldn't go to university if we didn't have any grants, which would be a huge number if they're actually telling the truth. I mean, the thing is, I mean, we've had this sort of thing with fees. I mean, you have students saying they don't like it, but then actually when it comes around, they cough up.
Yes,
they take on lots of debt, basically.
Yeah, I think when students are asked questions and say, you know, what will you do if this scenario and this scenario, people want to sound sort of rational and considered and have a sort of cost benefits scenario, but when it actually comes to sort of going where they end up, it's probably a less rational way of sort of decision making. But nonetheless, it is going to be interesting to think about whether the loss of grants will sort of create a less equal playing field, because it's feared by some that poorer students will need to take on more part-time work during term time, maybe live further away, so have to travel further, maybe not go to the university that they wanted to go to, staying close to home. So whether these things sort of make it harder for poorer students to get on and succeed, it is going to be interesting to look at.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it will be replaced by loans. Are they the same amount or are they?
You can take on higher loans, but there might be a resistance among some people to do that. I think it's, you know, it's quite a lot of money. I mean, I'm still paying off my maintenance loan from like 15 years ago, and
I barely made a dent in mine.
Poorer students are going to be asked to take on double that, And they might think, well, actually, you know, they get to a certain point where they think, actually, I'm not going to take on an extra loan. I'm going to try and find ways to manage my budget by, you know, saving money or living at home. So it could be, there hasn't really been any research done about what the impact might be. Yeah. And I think this is the first real study that looks at it.
Yeah, it's sort of flown under the radar a bit as well, politically, compared to the fees stuff. And I just wonder whether that's because the fees hit everyone, including sort of middle class families who had a much bigger voice in newspapers and so on. But this is going to affect much poorer families. So yeah, do read it. It's a fascinating survey. Ellie, you've got a new ranking for us and kind of snapshots of what's going on across the continent.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so the ranking is it's a top 200 list of the best universities in Europe. And it's drawn from data and the methodology used to compile our overall sort of world university rankings. And I mean, sort of unsurprisingly, the UK kind of dominates the list. It takes about a quarter of places in the ranking. Germany is the second most represented with 36 universities. Scandinavia does very well. We've done a bit of number crunching about how the countries perform relative to their GDP and their population size, and Finland and Sweden both do really well on both those counts. Sort of on the other end of the spectrum, the east and south of Europe don't do so well. So sort of Spain performs quite badly, Estonia, Portugal also bad, quite a lot of Eastern Europe just isn't represented at all in the top 200. So there's no universities from Poland or the Ukraine, for example. It's quite an interesting to see sort of how the various countries perform. The UK has a top three. It has Oxford, Cambridge, and Imperial. But yeah, I mean, as you said, there's also five opinion pieces that we've published from academics from five different countries, from some of them academics. The one from Germany is from the president of LMU Munich, which is the sort of top institution in Germany in the ranking.
It was really interesting. I mean, from what he's saying, German higher education, it's gone in two directions, really. There is a much more competitive element to it, sort of in line with the UK, and yet they've completely scrapped fees. So it's sort of, I guess it kind of shows that you don't have to go the same way on both these axes, really, towards a kind of high fee, high competition system. And Germany's kind of diverged in that sense.
Yeah, it is very interesting. I mean, obviously Germany's often used as a sort of example of maybe what the UK could achieve. And I sort of quoted Bernie Sanders, the presidential candidate in the US, who kind of mentioned Germany when he kind of talked about his vision for the US being tuition free. It's done just exceptionally well. I mean, Bernd Huber, the president of LMU Munich, notes that, 10 years ago, sort of competition among universities in Germany was not a priority. And they were sort of, the universities were generally just quite homogenous in quality. So what they've achieved in such a short period of time is quite impressive. I mean, a big part of that is the country's excellence initiative. So it's invested huge, like billions in its kind of top universities. But yeah, as you say, without kind of any tuition fees.
Well, exactly. He does sort of say at the end, let me remind British readers in particular that all this comes without tuition fees.
Yeah.
The breakdown of the number crunching is very, very interesting. I just wonder whether Germany would do even better, possibly even better than the UK, if it separates a lot of its research out from universities and puts its research into Max Planck institutes and Fraunhofer institutes and so on. So, university rankings may not even pick those up. I wonder if it would do even better.
Yeah, that feeling actually is sort of expressed by someone I mentioned, I quote in the feature, Paul Benaworth, who's an academic, higher education academic, who's done work in Germany, and he says that he thinks that the league tables sort of still fail to represent how strong Germany's higher education really is. And he says that, that part of that, he thinks, is maybe because other countries like Sweden are more aggressive at kind of looking at what league tables measure and then making sure that they can find a way to be strong on those elements. So there's a bit of kind of playing the game there.
One of the things about Germany, as I've written about in another story this week, is that their contract system is very strange. Almost all staff are on short-term contracts, and you're not allowed to really stay in academia beyond 6 years beyond your PhD unless you get a permanent job, which are really hard to get. So I think there's quite a lot of angst, I think, about some of the short-term contracts, which are sort of powering this the science and the research. Lots of German academics have to leave because they can't find a longer term post. So that's maybe the downside.
Yeah, maybe it's not so idealistic. Maybe the UK doesn't quite want what Germany has there.
Yeah, I wonder what Bernie Sanders would think of that. there's a brilliant and quite amusing, well, it's not, it's amusing on the one hand, very sad on the other, just completely ripping Ukraine's university system to shreds. Claims it's Stalinism fused with overwhelming corruption. Faculty members retain their positions until their deaths, surrounding themselves with their spouses, children, and other relations. Of course, there's a small matter of the war going on there as well. And Jack, you did a piece on this a few months ago on the president of Ukraine's National Academy of Sciences, who is 97 years old.
Yeah, he was re-elected last year. 97. He was actually born. I think he was born in 1918 on the very first day that the academy first met, back in like the sort of the Bolshevik times, pretty much. So it's quite amazing that he is still there.
He's I suppose that's, you know, they complain about Soviet era academic leaders. He's almost pre-Soviet, isn't he? He's so old. Anyway, it gives you a flavour of the problems in Ukrainian higher education. It's really interesting. Do read it. And finally, Jack, you've got a piece in the issue about a kind of X-factor style selection process for new researchers, and can it be of any actual use?
Yeah, this is a mock competition done by a Canadian medical school, and they, instead of just having a standard interview panel, they live streamed the interview to an audience of about 70 scientists and asked them to vote on who they thought should get the post.
Terrifying.
And actually 90% of the crowd voted for the same person that the interview panel gave it to. So it suggests that this sort of X Factor style poll might not be a bad thing. I mean, it could, you know, deliver the same results, but maybe in a more transparent and fun way.
Yeah, I suppose it shows that, as you say in the piece, it shows that the audience clearly then did have some idea of what people were looking for. So I guess it kind of gives you an idea of how you're supposed to perform in an interview.
Yeah, this was really what it was about, just asking scientists to reflect upon their presentation skills and sort of looking, because you don't really get the opportunity to see other people's interviews and see how they perform and what they do right and what they do wrong. So it was a good chance for people to sort of see what some of the candidates did right and what the others did wrong. And the person who won gave a compelling but non-dazzling performance. So you don't have to be a sort of, it doesn't have to be inspirational, it just has to be competent.
Okay, well, that's all we've got time for this issue review. It's both compelling and dazzling. You can find us on Twitter, on Facebook, and LinkedIn. So leave your comments on any of the stories and articles in this week's issue there. Or, of course, there's our website. You can comment on that, timeshighereducation.com. But until next week, goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.